Music 648, Folk and Ethnic Music in America. Instructor Dr. Lori Summers at Valdosta State University. Interviewer Kristen Olson. Interview date October 21st, 1995. Subject is Henry Rutland, a bluegrass fiddler from South Georgia. Interview taking place in Moultrie, Georgia. Try this again.
Okay.
Well, we'll just start over.
Yeah.
Okay. You asked the first question. I forgot where we left off.
We started out with how did you learn to play the fiddle and who taught you to play, and you were talking about your ancestors.
Okay. I learned to play from my daddy, which is he was a very good old time fiddle player. My granddaddy played fiddle also. He had a younger brother that played professionally and owned a nightclub in Dallas, Texas. And I believe I stated earlier, this went all the way back to two brothers that came to this country from England around 18 and 12. Both of those men played fiddle. One stayed up in and around the New England state of Vermont, and I believe there's a town named Rutland, Vermont. And the other brother migrated on into the Carolinas and later into Georgia, and that was beside the brother that where our family came from. And one of his sons or grandsons, which was my great grandfather, was in the Civil War in him and played and entertained the troops. And I have this fiddle at home now, which naturally has been restored several times, and that's where our side of the family got their fiddle playing from.
Okay.
And all, and I believe I stated earlier, I told you I had 1 year of violin lessons when I was a small boy in Macon, Georgia. But I definitely didn't want to play that type of music, having listened to my daddy and granddaddy play and having an uncle that would make guest appearance on the Grand Ole Opry. I definitely wanted to play country, hoedown type fiddle. And that's what I stayed with kind of all down through the years. You learn the basics and then you can branch off in any direction you want to from there. If you play by ear, and which I do, it's been so long since I tried to read music. At one time, I could play simple stuff by reading the notes and lines and spaces, but I learned to play by ear now.
Okay.
Play completely by ear.
Okay. You spoke about how your uncle taught you 99% of.
Oh yes, going back to my uncle. Uncle Bob, we called him, and his show name was Georgia Slim Rutland. I would go when he came back from Dallas, Texas in January of 1954 and started a taxi business in Valdosta. And after about 3 years, he sold that out and opened up a music store. And all along, I would take off a day from a work or a holiday and go over and spend the day with Uncle Bob, and we would play some, but we would sit and talk for hours about show business, handling music, entertaining people, just the business end of playing in the music industry. And he would often tell me, he said, "Son, when you're standing up there playing, and that big silly grin on your face, that's only about 2 or 3% of it. The rest of it is negotiating, dealing with people, trying to get contracts, putting bands together and all. It's a very demanding business if you stay with it and have to do it all yourself, you know. And that's if you get into the big time, the Nashville or the Branson, Missouri scene, or Austin, Texas scene, and all, you have people do that for you. But on a smaller scale, just starting out, you have to do all of it yourself. And we would talk for hours on the business end of it, and the show business and entertainment and what all it was involved in the music world, you know.
And you continue to play, but it's not for a living.
That's true. I saw at a very young age that for a side man or just a working musician, there wasn't too much money there, and so I became involved in surveying and engineering. I made a career with the Georgia Highway Department. I retired as a field engineer, and presently I'm working here in Moultrie as the Crawford County Road Engineer, and play my music on the weekends and part-time as a hobby, as we like to say, a profitable hobby. During the fall and winter months, I play bluegrass music with some guys in Thomasville. We entertain the plantations and the hunting lodges during the winter months, and then during the spring and summer and early fall, I play with a modern country and western dance band. I'm working one night a week here in Moultrie at the Moose Lodge on Saturday night, and I enjoy all types of music. I won't mention any specific music, but there's one or two kinds. It don't take but just a little bit to get my fill of, but as far as music that can be played on the fiddle, I enjoy all types of that type of music, you know. But basically, I enjoy the most bluegrass, country and western, and western swing. That's about the three main types of fiddle music that I've been involved in, and all. And I've tried to learn to play just a little bit of all three types, but preferably the bluegrass music is my favorite, you know. And I just seem like I enjoy that the most.
How much do you rehearse and practice?
With our bluegrass band, we practice on Tuesday nights about 2.5 to 3 hours. And then when I'm at home by myself, I try to practice 10 to 15 minutes every day, but if I miss 2 or 3 days in a row, maybe the third day I'll try to practice 45 minutes or at least an hour to make up for the lost time. And I mean, keeping the old fingers limber and playing double notes and a little bit of triple notes, and the bowing is a big portion of a playing in fiddle or violin, is the control of the bow. And I heard someone say one time that if he missed practice for one day, he knew it. If he missed practice for 2 or 3 days, the guys in the band knew it. And if he missed practice for a week or two, the whole world knew it. And I'll certainly have to go along with that idea.
So you primarily perform at the hunting lodges and the Moose Lodge and
right, local,
like this.
Local places. All along we get to play a convention or county commissioner's convention. We have played that twice in Savannah, I believe it was, and we entertained Georgia Power and went all the way to Athens one time. And we get a lot of jobs that these people will come down to these hunting lodges and hear us play, and then we'll go back home, and they will go back home, and we'll hear from them to entertain in their type business and all. And it kind of branches off from these hunting lodges, stuff like that, you know.
And what's the name of the group that you play with, the bluegrass group?
Our bluegrass band is called the South Georgia Grass. There was so many people has got so many different names, and we just decided that since we're all from in and around this Thomasville area there, that South Georgia Grass would be a pretty good name, and it stayed with us now for about 10 or 15 years.
Okay. Who has primarily influenced your playing of anybody? Is there anyone in particular or any group in particular?
Well, I'll have to say that for a long period in my life that my uncle, Robert Rutland, influenced me and the most, because he was such a very good and great fiddle player. And then as time went along, I began to hear other fiddle players that played things a little bit different from the way Uncle Bob did. And the man that he was in business with for a number of years, Howard, stage name Big Howdy Forrester, played some of the old reels, hornpipes, and ragtime tunes. He played them and emphasized a lot of the notes a little different from Uncle Slim. The first bluegrass fiddle player that I got to hear live rather than on stage.
The man that plays at three up there.
Thank you. It was a young man out of Spanishburg, West Virginia. He came to this part of the country with a band, Jim and Jesse, and the Virginia Boys. His name was Joe Meadows. And when we were playing the festival circuit real regular, that I would run into Joe quite often, and we become real good friends, even though that we didn't see each other but five or six times a year. I liked Joe's fiddle playing, and he began to show me a lot of the fill-ins and all that was used in bluegrass music. Another fiddle player that everybody listened to and tried to play a lot like was when Flat Scruggs was at their heyday, was in the early 50s, Paul Warren was a fiddle player with them. And time went by, there was a fiddle player out of Kissimmee, Florida, of Vassar Clemens, that played some real progressive bluegrass. And as years went by, there was a fiddle player that made the scene somewhere in the middle to latter 50s, a Kenny Baker out of Kentucky. And he worked with the legendary Bill Monroe off and on for about 20 to 25 years. And in bluegrass music, I guess that he was about the best and well-liked among everybody and recognized as the world's best in bluegrass music. And along at the same time, the people playing Western swing and Western music from the Texas and Oklahoma area, there was a Johnny Gimble that he was played just as well a Western swing type fiddle as Kenny Baker did bluegrass fiddle. And I would listen to both of these guys and try to incorporate some of their runs and passages into my music. And my uncle would always tell me, son, says, don't never get on that stage and try to imitate another fiddle player, no matter how good he is, because you're only selling that man's material. You need to produce and have your own, no matter, you might never be as good as some of those professional people, but when you stand up and play, says, well, that's the way Henry Rutland learned to play it, you know. And I'll always remember that, and oh, you'll always add a few of the other people's licks and notes here and there all along, but basically you try to build your own tunes and play your own numbers the way that you hear them and feel them. And that's what I've tried to do down through the years, is play it my way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I play a number now, you hear a few traces of other people and all, but when you stray away from the simple melody and getting into the, I think the correct words is grace notes, syncopation, syncopated lead lines, oh, they, you could run on in a lot of different names. And this is the old country boys around here, so he's playing the hot stuff now. That's kind of the way we speak of it, you know. And also, you can, I have noticed a lot of the young fiddle players this day and time they start playing for one another rather than the listening public, and they get so red hot and all with their music that you can't tell the melody line anymore.
Okay, so these gentlemen that influenced your playing, was this personal contact with them, or records, or the radio, or television, or?
Just a little bit of everything. I would see them on the televisions and hear them on radio and record, and then in the festival season, they would travel to the festivals out of Nashville, Tennessee. That's where they were all living. And I'd get to meet them and play some with them and have jam sessions. And I would meet them during the festival season, meet them personally. And I got to know every one of those people personally and become, I'll say, friends, even though I didn't get to see them three or four, five times a year. And then I'd go into Nashville on a vacation or something like that and spend some time with them. But I got to meet all of these people personally. And I have their record albums, and I've done a little bit of recording down through the years. I might add that I have a first cousin, George Custer, that he and I played for several years on the festival circuit as a twin fiddle team, and he had spent a little time in Texas and played some with Uncle Bob in his nightclub, and when he retired from the Navy in 72, I believe it was, he and I would book 8 or 10 festivals a year just as a twin fiddle team and play some of the old twin fiddle numbers. We'd have the bluegrass type backup with the banjo, guitar, mandolin, and bass. We recorded one album and got to work a week at the World's Fair in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1982 just as a twin fiddle team. And what we would, when we were there, what we'd done was we put together a good 30-minute show of twin fiddle numbers, and we played that show, I think it was 7 times. We had 7 30-minute shows a day, and at the end of 6 days, we had just about had enough fiddle playing for 1 week.
Just taking your spin over there. Here, partner. Take care of
the spin. So the festivals that you're speaking of, when exactly was this festival season, and what were the most important festivals to attend then?
I guess it all got started in the latter 60s for us down in this part of the country was the Florida Folks Festival at White Springs, Florida. Everybody got the idea to hire 6 or 8 bands and try to have it on a professional and paying basis, and one of the big ones that stayed in business a good long while was down at Lauty, Florida, and they would hire 5 or 6 amateur groups and then hire 1 or 2 big professional names out of Nashville, and they'd have 3 or 4 festivals a year at these places. That one stayed in business 10 or 15 years, and then there were several that opened up down in Central Florida and Middle and South Georgia. These things have a trend. After about 10 or 12 years, they begin to die out and fold up and no longer in business, you know. And one thing, as far as our playing and all, we would charge a small amount to take care of the gasoline and motel room and expenses like motels and food. And a lot of the younger musicians, I'll say teenagers, they would go in there and start play the whole weekend free. And that we just had to quit. We couldn't go and compete going and playing for free when they was charging a pretty good prices at the gate to get in. The promoters was using up all the money and paying the big timers and keeping the rest for themselves, and so we slowly but surely, we got out of the festival business right quick and started doing private parties, hunting lodges and stuff like that to make a little money. If we were going to play free, we'd play at home in the living room or a little local private parties and all. And I haven't played a festival in quite some time in this part of the country and all. It's more or less hunting lodges and private parties and the nightclub work.
You described a typical bluegrass group. Have you seen any variations on that? What's the normal instrumentation, or have you run into any interesting variations on what's used in a bluegrass group, or just pretty much standard?
This goes back when it all got started somewhere in the early 40s. Bill Monroe put together the first bluegrass band, and the typical five instruments in a bluegrass band is fiddle, banjo, guitar, mandolin, and the old upright bass. Now, as time went by, they incorporated a dobro, which is a Hawaiian type guitar. The guy I'm speaking that got that started was Buck Graves, that played with the great Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. Now, the dobro was being played in country music quite some time before it got involved in bluegrass music. Roy Acuff had a musician, his bashful brother Oswald, and he played the old Hawaiian steel type guitar, but he played early country music on that, and it was Buck Graves that got this dobro into bluegrass music with Flatt and Scruggs in the early 50s. There's been a few harmonica players that has been in bluegrass music, but your basic instruments in a bluegrass band is fiddle, banjo, guitar, mandolin, and bass.
A lot of the focus in my paper is the difference between country and bluegrass, and I was wondering if maybe you could give me your perceptions of what you perceive as the difference between country music and bluegrass, since you play both. When you're thinking about each type, what is the difference that you perceive between the two?
I guess my answer to that, generally speaking, bluegrass music is a type of music played to be listened to about 98%. All of your notes and your little fill-ins and turnarounds are played a lot faster. Whereas in country music and western swing, that music was more or less developed to dance as dance music, and it's played a lot slower. But as a musician yourself, you know, these same grace notes, the fill-ins, can be played at a slower pace as well as a faster pace, but simply bluegrass music is played with more speed and a more of a drive rather than the country and western swing type music.
Okay, so the tempos of the pieces that you play are primarily fast.
That's true.
Okay, and you're...
Even though there's a lot of slower songs, people speak of fast and all, and you have to think of drive. Now, you can play music with a drive. You can play a waltz with a drive. Mm-hmm. And it takes another musician to really know and understand what I'm trying to explain and talk about. Even though you might be playing something slow, there's a drive there that's in the music. And to me, most bluegrass music musicians, as well as the music itself, I can feel and hear a greater drive in and among bluegrass musicians and bluegrass music rather than the country and western swing musicians, which there's a lot of good musicians in all three fields of music, but I can feel it and see it more so in the bluegrass type of music.
Back to the instrumentation just for a second. What role does each instrument play in the ensemble?
Well, when it all started, you had the guitar was played the rhythm, the bass played the bass notes, and those two instruments kept the rhythm more so. Now, with the mandolin, if you're acquainted with bluegrass music, the mandolin with that downbeat or down chop, we call it, that is your three basic rhythm instruments. Now, your fiddle, your banjo, and the mandolin was considered lead instruments, but in later years, there's some real fine lead guitar players that basically they play rhythm, but they can step up and take a hot lead in some of the music they set up. One name comes to me right quick is Tony Rice, and then there's a Dan Carey, and a Norman Blake. That's some that comes to mind right quick that were real fantastic flat top musicians, and one of the smoothest and greatest that I've always remember was Doc Watson, the blind guitar player. He learned that his music, it would go early country as well as bluegrass. He played some of it both, and he would play it to where you couldn't just put one category on his music and all. But he always had his son there, the late Travis, I believe it was. No, Merle Watson, the young fella that got killed in a tractor accident. He played, when I saw him, he played rhythm guitar for his dad, Doc, to sing, and Doc would play the lead note. As time went by, Merle began to play some fingerstyle guitar. And all, but when I saw him, he was just playing rhythm guitar for his dad, Doc Watson. But the true three lead instruments in bluegrass music was the fiddle, banjo, and mandolin. And this all got started, if I can remember all the names, back in the early 40s, when Bill Monroe put the band together. There was Chubby Wise on fiddle. He was a two-finger style banjo player with him for a short while. String Bean was his stage name. And then after him was the great Earl Scruggs, and had Lester Flatt on rhythm guitar, I believe it was. And Cedric Howard Rainwater, I believe, on the bass fiddle. These names get away from me after a while, but that's where it all kind of got started, and it progressed and developed from there. That was considered the very first super bluegrass band, was when Bill Monroe had Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and with him, and Chubby Wise on fiddle. And Chubby Wise is recognized among most everyone in this part of the country as the first bluegrass fiddle player, and the old fella is still living and performing a limited number of festivals, and he's in a little place just this side of Jacksonville, St. Mary, Florida, I believe it is, not too far east of Lake City.
So those gentlemen back in the 40s took what was typically considered country music at
early
the time
country,
and applied a different drive and
right,
used it mostly for listening rather than for dancing, and that's
right,
how bluegrass developed from country.
That's right. Now, for years and years, they would have the square dance type and fiddle playing and all. As time went by, they began to write some songs and all that would play to this faster type tempo. And that's kind of where it developed from to where it is today.
Do the songs that you typically play in bluegrass have any typical ethnic background to them? Are they originating from any one particular immigrants from one particular country or a couple of different countries, or is it just from all over the place?
I believe if you get some of the old typical bluegrass songbooks and evaluate each song, each and every line, it would tell true stories of how those people live in the mountain states of Tennessee, Kentucky, the Carolinas, and Georgia, and places like that. And each one tells the story of the life and times of how life was back there, whether it was love affairs, a hard day's work, or even songs have been written about murder stories and stuff like that. But they wrote about the life and times of that era of time there, I'd say from the early 1900s. Some of the songs go way back to the early to middle 1800s, some Civil War songs and stuff like that. But most of them, I would say, was written about the environment that they lived in, the things that they saw and done every day, and personal problems and personal true life experiences that they lived, dealt with every day on a daily basis. And all that's the way I have observed a lot of that stuff, you know. Train wrecks, maybe a man killing his girlfriend or something like that, you know. There's a lot of stories, even horse races. Bill Monroe got one about two horses, Molly and Tillenbrooks. It tells a story of a great horse race there somewhere in eastern Kentucky. The old bluegrass number, Molly and Tillenbrooks, you know. And I believe it was 90% dealing with their way of life at that time.
Okay. A lot of my next few questions have to do with the playing style of music. Are there special techniques characteristic to bluegrass music that are specific to bluegrass? Is there a specific, a typical harmonic structure, you know, chord progressions, or I'm looking for things that are typically characteristic to it that might be different from other forms of music. Characteristic rhythms or placements of accents or dynamic change. Is there a volume change involved, or is it primarily one volume, that type of thing?
I'm going to try to answer your questions as best as I know how. In bluegrass music, you have some pretty melodies, and at the end of each line, you would play a combination of fill-in type notes, of faster consecutive notes, whereas in country music, in swing music, you would play longer, more sustained notes, where in bluegrass music you would fiddle out a line, where in country and western swing you would hold one note there for three or four beats, where in bluegrass you would get into a 16th and sometimes 32nd notes. And all this goes back to what the musician himself hears in the back of his mind and he feels at that time with a big part of playing by ears, according to what are you feeling and thinking, and how many nights have you played and all that, playing by ear, you know. If you're feeling kind of tired, sad, and run down, aggravated, you don't play as hot and feel as well. And if you hadn't played in several weeks and you go have a job somewhere, you'll be full of fire and ready to play and all, and play a lot more progressive stuff than you would if you just got off a three or four night job, you know.
So you're primarily, you do a lot of improvisation when you play, and it's not the same as it was when you played the same song maybe several years ago.
That's true. You just can't remember all that stuff. You can remember a big portion of it. You can play the chord progression and stuff like that.
Uh-huh. But, the younger musicians that are writing it down, are they composing their own bluegrass music, and that's how they're writing it down, or are they writing down what they're learning from older fiddle players?
What I have observed, they'll go tape a bluegrass concert. They'll take it back home. And they have the ability to play that back and write out each note that they hear. And once they hear that, they have got the ability to play a little bit of everything they hear, you know.
And it has come a long way, I'd say, in the last 30 to 40 years. We're going to do our instrumentals by banjo players is Earl Scruggs and all, and the fiddle player that would do his part in that music was the Paul Warren that I told you about, and the fiddle and banjo complemented one another in a manner of speaking. And like I think I told you earlier, that Paul Warren was one of my very favorite fiddle players that I listened to in the very early 50s in the bluegrass field of music. And all that. That was back when Flat and Scruggs was in their heyday.
And that's when he played with Flat and Scruggs?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So would you consider Flat and Scruggs then your favorite group because of him, or?
Yes, they broke away from old Bill Monroe in 1949 or 50, and they presented their music just a little bit different. The singing, had phrasing was just a little bit different, and you'd have to sit and listen to the old records to see exactly what I'm talking about. Seemed like it didn't have any more drive, but it was more appealing to the listening audience. And Monroe had been doing his music some 12 or 14 years, and they came out with just a little bit different approach to the bluegrass music and played their grace notes and fill-ins and all. That's when the dobro by Josh Buck Graves became very popular in the bluegrass field of music. And of course, they had the mandolin, banjo, and fiddle as their lead instruments, but the dobro made four. And when they would play a number, they would always feature all four of these lead instruments, where with Monroe, it was just fiddle and banjo and mandolin. And on the slower numbers, he would leave the banjo out. It would be just fiddle and mandolin. But when Flat and Scruggs got into the picture, they tried to feature all four of the instruments, regardless whether they were playing a very fast number or a very slow number. They still featured all four of the instruments. And I guess that's why they rose to fame so very quickly there in the early and mid-50s, I believe it was. I remember the great song that Ricky Skaggs had out and made a big hit out of it, Crying My Heart Out Over You. Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs recorded that in the early part of 1951. And Scruggs and Ricky Skaggs came out a few years back with his big hit out of it. A lot of people didn't realize that that number had been recorded when Ricky was just a real small kid, you know.
We were noticing that you're just played with your guitar player. You're both acoustic. There wasn't any electrical instruments. Do you use electrical instruments?
Not in bluegrass music whatsoever. Now, in later years, people have accepted an electric bass because upright bass players, good ones, are hard to find. But bluegrass music has always been played acoustic.
So that's another difference between country and bluegrass.
Another.
Okay.
That is the main and part. And to me, I've always enjoyed the tone of an acoustic instrument, whether it's a fiddle, guitar, banjo, or mandolin. I enjoy hearing acoustic music and all. Some of the younger musicians think when they start to play the guitars and basses and electric instruments, the louder the better, but to me that's far from the truth. It gets to be awful noise to me after a while. As you can probably hear some of it going on here this afternoon. I can see the rafters in this old courthouse shaking and the limbs and trees. To me, it gets beyond the point of being good music when it gets so loud. It hurts your ears to listen to it. And to me, the notes gets distorted so bad that you can't tell one from another. To me, it's just a loud, awful noise. And I just don't like that type of music whatsoever.
The other thing I wanted to ask you is, when you play your violin in bluegrass, do you tune it to the typical string notes on a violin?
Yes.
Or do you ever retune it?
There's some old show numbers that requires different tuning, but 99% of what I play is the standard tuning E-A-D-G, which is five notes apart or tuned in fifths, as you know in music. In later years, they have added a lower note on the left hand or bass side of a fiddle, come out with a five string fiddle, which I have one. I've been playing it now about 4 years, but I use it strictly in country and western swing dance music, playing it acoustically with a bluegrass band. Unless you have a real good sound man, when you go to play those bass notes, it kind of gets drowned out. There's a few people playing those bluegrass type music on the five string fiddles, but I chose just to play it electric through an amplifier. And when I play bluegrass music, I use just a simple four string fiddle as you saw me playing today.
Okay.
Even though there are one or two people in bluegrass that's using that, but when you play a concert, the sound man has got to know exactly when to bring that bass note up, don't it? If not, it gets drowned out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I chose just to use a simple four-string fiddle.
Now, you mentioned the difference in a particular song between a Texas version and a Georgia version. Are there regional differences in bluegrass music?
Oh, yes. I've managed to travel a little bit up and down the East Coast into the Carolinas and Virginia. And each area of the country, you will find a little bit different in the phrasing of the notes. And the Texas version of the old Cotton Eye Joe I played this afternoon, as you saw, had a kind of a bounce to it, that where they would do a kind of a line dance or bebop, the old jitterbug type thing. Whereas in the Georgia or southeastern version of the tune Cotton Eye Joe was a very fast-paced hold-down number used basically as for square dancing numbers. And I put that number on an album back in 78. The old traditional hold-down version of Cotton Eye Joe, and playing at festivals when I was playing regularly, that was well-liked and well-received because I played it at a very, very fast pace. Whereas the version I played this afternoon, you probably recognize the little bounce or dance version to it, you know.
Okay. What's your favorite piece? If you had to pick a favorite bluegrass piece, do you have one?
These numbers get tangled together, and there's a lot of the fiddle tunes played in each style of music. One of my very favorites has been recorded in both styles by a lot of fiddle players is the old fiddle tune Sally Gooden, and that's a favorite among fiddle players in both fields of music, and has been played quite a bit up and down the road. I guess one of my very favorite bluegrass fiddle tunes came out about 8 or 10 years ago by the great Bill Monroe, was one called The Gold Rush. It had some very pretty fiddling. Well, to me, all the numbers in bluegrass music are very pretty. There was one or two that he featured the mandolin in, one called Panhandle Country, and then in Rawhide was featured the mandolin more so than the fiddle, which you fiddled on a part and back up. And then in some of the fiddle tunes, along with the Gold Rush, was one called Roanoke, which featured the, I believe he had a twin fiddle version. And there's another one he had out on record, Salt Creek, which was real good. And having traveled a little bit in the eastern part of the United States. In our southeastern states here, that number is called Salt Creek, and is played at a very fast pace in bluegrass music. Got out in Texas and Oklahoma a time or two, and they play the same number quite a bit slower, but they call it Salt River out there. Is the practically the same tune, only it's played twice as fast in bluegrass music, and with one called Salt Creek and one called Salt River. And the boys and I that I play with back home, we recently put that on an album, and they supposed to be mailed back to us around November the 1st. And we recorded that number as Salt Creek.
Bluegrass changed or evolved since you began playing, and has your own style changed along those lines?
I have noticed long, I'm going to say somewhere in the early 60s, that some of the younger people got involved in bluegrass. Some of them were well-schooled musicians. They started what we call progressive bluegrass and almost made it into a jazz type music, which if you listen to bluegrass today in some of the major festivals, you can definitely tell a difference between what we call traditional bluegrass and the newer modern or progressive.
Okay.
One of the first groups that got involved into this type of progressive bluegrass several years back was the Seldom Scene up in around the Northern Virginia and Washington DC area. Another group, the Country Gentlemen, was a group from that part of the country. They got involved into the ways, but for some reason at some point in time they began to back away from the progressive type music and went back to the old traditional type music, which to me, it will never be replaced. It will always be played as traditional. You listen to some of the real younger early teenagers playing today, you can hear them play the numbers just like Bill Monroe and Lester Flatt, Earl Scruggs, maybe Ralph Stanley, and some of the people put on record 35, 40 years ago. They are young teenagers, and they're still trying to play this music as traditional as when they first heard it. And then, like I say, the other form of bluegrass is the progressive, which is played by the younger people. You can tell that they're which style that they're trying to follow. And to me, the old tradition will always be here, and it will always be loved by everybody. And but I also believe that there will be a lot of people that still will play and enjoy the progressive type music, but I believe the feel for the traditional type bluegrass, it will always be the greatest. That's my personal feeling.
So it's as far as where it's headed then, it has expanded into progressive bluegrass, but it's coming back to more people being interested in traditional, you think?
Personally, I have observed that. I noticed a lot of young banjo players as well as young fiddle players and mandolin players. They would get started and they would learn a lot of the old traditional numbers. And then they would see and hear the older, more accomplished musicians playing this progressive type music, and they would get all out into left field with it. I've been to festivals, I'm sure you have too, where the progressive type musicians would play one or two numbers, and by the third number, people began to walk off and leave them. They didn't want to hear, probably because they were playing music and so many notes and all, they were playing over the people's head. They didn't know and understand what they were playing. That group would get off the stage, a traditional group would come on the stage, and the audience would fill back up. People just didn't want to hear as much as this progressive stuff. And I saw these same younger musicians see right quick the where music was going, and I'm thankful that a big portion of them come back to traditional bluegrass music, you know.
That leads me right into one of my last questions. Bluegrass and country, are they remaining pretty separate styles of music, or is there some crossover occurring, or do you see them coming together closer in style or remaining as different?
In regards to your question, I see a lot of bluegrass musicians that started out in the bluegrass field of music. I play bluegrass basically as a hobby because I like the music. I'll give you a few examples of what has happened. Ricky Skaggs, at one time when he started out in the bluegrass field of music, he worked for Ralph Stanley, which is just as traditional bluegrass music as can be played. Then he worked with the Seldom Seen, and a few years later he branched out on his own in the country music field of music. And another example was another young fella by the name of Keith Whitley, started up the same route with traditional bluegrass music. And a few years later, a young man, Vince Gill, done the same thing. And that I see the people that try to play music professionally, they are having to leave bluegrass music and go into modern country music to make a living. But the people that play music as a hobby and maybe just on the weekends, they stay with the traditional type music. Now there's not near as greater demand anywhere as I can think of for bluegrass music as country music. I think you could probably take a poll on the street out here today and interview X number of people and you'd find out maybe only 5 or 6% of those people tell you that they like bluegrass the best, that they really like country the best. But the ones that did say that they like bluegrass music, I have people in my own hometown will drive 500 and 600 miles to a bluegrass festival and sit there 3 days a night just to get to hear good bluegrass music. They probably wouldn't even turn the radio on to hear modern country music. That's just the way they feel about it. They feel for country music is, has such a greater demand, but the small percentage of people that like and enjoy bluegrass music really love it and care for it, and they don't care to listen to anything else.
My last question, I promise.
That's all right.
You spoke about how meeting people at festivals and listening to the radio and watching television and records and things, all these other bluegrass artists and bluegrass fiddlers influenced your style. Has it blended with what you learned then from your dad and your Uncle Bob, or has it what you've been influenced by from the media replaced that, or are you just incorporating it? I'm trying to get how the media has influenced you personally and what's happened because of that.
I would say that I learned the traditional hoedown numbers from my dad and Uncle Bob. And Uncle Bob's theory, he tell me, son, go and listen to every man that picks up and plays a fiddle. He might not be a very good fiddle player, but he'll play just a few notes, maybe one or two lines that you've never heard before. It might not be all that good, but you can always add that to your collection. And we like to say that in learning and playing, it's like getting a big bag of tricks. You learn and pick out the best and finer points from every musician and the notes that they play. I've got a record collection of fiddle albums that would fill up 2 Army footlockers. I have 500 or 600 fiddle, nothing but fiddle albums. And by listening to all these people I've picked out and gained and learned a few notes from everyone I've ever heard and listened to. And if you stood and tried to play a number, and from all the notes you had learned down from each and every fiddle player, you might have to stand there and play the same number for 3 or 4 hours. But what I've tried to do is just pick out some of the finer notes and passages and stuff that would be pleasing to the audience as well as myself. And in regards to your question, that yes, I did try to learn just a little bit and listen to everything every one of those fiddle players
played. But it hasn't replaced what you learned today.
It hadn't replaced the basics, you know. There's, as you well know, there's only 7 notes and 7 chords, and there's only, you can just add so much before you begin to lose the melody. That goes back to this progressive type music. Though we like to say that those young fellas start playing to one another rather than the good listening audience out there, and I'm sure you've heard them stand up and play numbers that they just got completely away from the melody line, even though I've heard some of them play some of the tunes that I've heard all my life. At some point in time, they got so far away from the melody line that I couldn't tell what they were even playing until they finally drifted back to the old true melody. And I think you can overplay any number, any type of instrument, you can overplay. To me, overplaying is as bad as not playing well enough. Yes, I've tried to learn a little bit from every fiddle player I've ever met.
Great. I think that does it. Thank you so much.
Okay.